The unsurpassed, penetrating, and perfect truth is seldom met with, even 100,000 myriad kalpas. Now we can see and hear it, we can remember and accept it. I vow to make the Buddha's truth one with myself. Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha. You'll have to forgive me, I'm not a very good reader, and I'm going to have to be reading some of the excerpts from the scripture on the Buddha's last teaching, so put up with my stumblings. We're here to celebrate the Buddha's death, which doesn't seem like a great cause for celebration, but the Buddha was a human being just like everybody else, and he could have lived for 100 years, but at 80 years old he was told, Ananda, a number of times that he was getting on and he was feeling that it was time to end his life. And Ananda never picked up on the hint that he could have encouraged him to live a little longer, and he received a lot of flack from the other monks for not doing this. But he was 80, he was ready to go. He chose to die in a place called Kushinagara, which was a very humble little village. It had once been a big city. I saw a video recently of some of the shrines they have there now. And it's become now a place of pilgrimage for Buddhists to attend. He was invited to a meal by a man named Kunda. And Kunda gave him some food that caused him to die. And since there weren't, this was before the time of printed language, we don't have the newspaper's accounts are a little bit varied. on what this meal was, whether it was from meat or whether it was from a poison mushroom or something. In any event, the Buddha took it, and he had some karma from a doctor who had deliberately given somebody bad medicine and caused their death. And this is what this karma ripened at this meal and to cause his death. And at one point, he was stopping to choose the place where he was going to die, and he asked Ananda to get him some water from this little river. And Ananda didn't want to do it because the water was all muddy, and the Buddha had to tell him again and again, no, get the water from that river. So he went, when Ananda actually went to the river, the water was very clear. But Ananda had to get over his doubts, what the Buddha was saying. And then there was a man named Subhadra who came up and wanted to question the Buddha about his teaching. And Ananda wanted to keep him from bothering the Buddha. But the Buddha said, no, Ananda, it's okay. Let him come. And he gave him answered his questions and then gave him an ordination. And he was the last person that the Buddha personally ordained. And he attained arhatship that night. We have a picture of the death of the Buddha on the altar, and I've got a photocopy of this here, and Akimi was kind enough to identify some of the people who were at his death, and you can look at it after the talk. After Subhadra's ordination, he gave his last teachings, and they're addressed to monks. But I think there's a lot that's appropriate to everyone. So I picked out a few of the things that seem to be most relevant for everybody. He said, after I enter into eternal meditation, you should deeply honor, esteem, and revere as precious the 10 great and the 48 less grave precepts. Just as darkness encounters brightness, or as a destitute person receives a treasure, So you should recognize these as your great teachers. While I abided in this world, they were indeed none different than these for me. The precepts are what is appropriate to and in accord with the foundation and the source of liberation. This is why they are called the pratimokshas, or that which leads one toward liberation. Accordingly, these precepts can beget various meditations and the wisdom that eradicates suffering. Keep to these pure precepts without giving others cause to slander you. If you can keep to these pure precepts, you should know that this can have spiritual benefits for self and others. For those who do not have the precepts, all goodness, merits, and virtues cannot produce for them what they need to know. The precepts are foremost in well-being, the abiding place of merit and virtue. This is why they're so important for us, because they're the place of grounding that restless mind. It's not so much that you have to get something. You already have the Buddha nature. We're already enlightened, but we do a lot of things that are not necessarily enlightened things. And it's our willingness to restrain the self. So much of what this practice is it's the not doing. Restraining from causing harm, restraining from killing, restraining from lying. And that self-restraint is the thing that allows us to be at peace. And the precepts and the meditation are the thing that allows us to see how to change ourselves. Since you already abide in the precepts, you should work on regulating your five senses. Do not wantingly enter into the desires that arise from them. You are, for example, just as an ox herder who holds his staff in hand and needs to show it to his ox. Do not indulge in idleness, letting that which does not keep the precepts sow its seeds and grow its crops. For if you indulge your five senses, not only will your desires, which know no bounds, be ungovernable, but they will also be as an unruly horse that, uncontrolled by a bridle, threatens to drag the trainer along until he tumbles into some hole. Wise are the ones who is the governor and regulator of his senses and not their follower. Treat them as though they were thieves. The senses are the places where the emotions arise. And our emotions are conditioned by our old karma, our likes and our dislikes, our desires, our fears, our angers, our frustrations. And it's not that you have to get rid of them, but you have to change your relationship to them. What started me meditating was a car accident where I hit my head on the windshield and was waiting for the doctors to take the glass out of my face and talked myself into just being still. I'd read about Buddhism for about 10 years, but hadn't actually done anything about meditation. And as I continued to talk myself into being still, don't touch your face, don't blink, don't move, I fell into this place where I was there and the pain was there, but it didn't hurt anymore. It was just sensation. And there's this little subtle shift that takes place. When you don't want something to be there, it hurts a whole lot more than when you just accept the fact that it is there and you don't have to do anything about it. And this acceptance is part of this process of accepting the fact that suffering exists in this universe. And it just comes with the territory. Doesn't have to be suffering if we can change our relationship to it. And it's understanding that we turn these senses into suffering by either wanting more of them or not wanting them. And that those are the relationships that are conditioned by our old karma. And when we think differently about these things, they take on a different meaning. So he's going to talk about food here. When receiving food or drink, you should look upon it as though upon the ingesting of medicine. Do not give rise to fluctuations in judgment by weighing it on the scales of good or bad. Be prompt to ingest it as a support for your body, which removes hunger and thirst. At the same time, be as a honeybee who, whilst gathering pollen from a flower, only takes the nectar and does not spoil or destroy the flower's color, shape, or scent. In other words, don't leave a karmic wake behind you in what you're doing, whether it's eating or whatever it is that you happen to be doing. Try to do it like the bee collecting the nectar from the flower. A defiling passion is a poisonous serpent asleep in your heart. It's like having a black viper in your room while you sleep. You must quickly snare this serpent by keeping to the precepts. Drive it off and remove it from your room. Then you can sleep peacefully and in safety. If it does not depart and you close your eyes to it, you are the same as a person who lacks true modesty. That is, you will lack awareness of your susceptibilities and remorse for your shortcomings. For of all things splendorous, modesty is the foremost. It is as a cast iron restraint which restrains others without recourse to any other thing. You should always act with a modest heart, without neglecting it, even for a short while. If you separate yourself from your feelings of modesty, then you lose merit and virtue. When there are people who are modest, then there will be good teaching. If people lack modesty, there's no difference between them and the birds and the beast. Modesty is a bit different from humility. In our culture, humility tends to come from a place of feeling less than adequate. And modesty is different here. Modesty is the sense of self-restraint, of recognizing food as medicine, recognizing pain as pain, and not necessarily seeing it as suffering. If you indulge in a raging or resentful heart, then you make yourself an obstacle in your own path and lose the benefits of your merit and virtue. Forbear for virtue's sake and keep to the precepts. For if you act in this way, you reach what seems to be impossible. The one who can behave with forbearance is called a great and powerful person. If there are those who cannot be joyful and delight in others, forbearance will accept the poison of their malice and curses as a person drinking the sweet dew. It's not easy to do. You should realize that an angry heart depends upon a fierce flame. So be on guard, without crossing over into anger and resentment, lest you let these thieves of kulpas of merit and virtue gain entrance. When common folk embrace their greeds, they are people who walk not in the way. They lack the teaching to restrain themselves, so that their anger can still harbor resentment and find fault with others. When monks walk in the way, there are people who do not hanker after things, so that the attachments which give rise to anger and resentment become all but impossible. These are very accomplished monks. Not all monks are this good. just as one who, at the sound of the first sound of thunder amidst the chill embracing clouds, starts up a fire. It's not fitting to enkindle anger at the first signs of coldness or trouble. The mind that is flattering and fawning acts contrary to the way. Therefore, keep your heart honest and forthright. For should you realize that flattery and fawning are merely done for the sake of imposing on others or making fools of them, maintain an upright heart, which will serve as a foundation for your honesty and forthrightness. Recognize the person who has many cravings. His misery and troubles are many because he seeks after benefits, gains, and advantages. The person with few cravings is free from seeking after things or yearning for them. We live in a society that's constantly bombarded with little messages that you need more stuff. You need something new, you need something more. You gotta replace your clothes, your cars, your house, your whatever every once in a while. And there's this constant pressure to have more. And you know, that's just what we're conditioned with. And we have to see that we can uncondition ourselves. We were being urged the other day to take more of the offerings because we weren't taking enough. And this constant pressure to have more or get something new or whatever comes out of this fundamental feeling that you're inadequate or you lack something. And although we're conditioned in this way, that's what the Buddhist teachings are all about, is to recognize you already have this wholeness within you and you have to start acting on it. And the more you act on it, the more you can realize that wholeness. But it's up to you to make that choice. We have to see where we're acting out of old habits and see how we can change them. If you wish to be free from miseries and woes, look into contentment, which is synonymous with knowing what is enough. The teaching of contentment is none other than the location of true wealth, ease, security, and peace. The person who is contented, though he sleeps upon the bare ground, is still at ease and satisfied. Someone who is discontented, even if he were ensconced in a celestial palace, would still not find this tallying with his ideas and tastes. The one who is discontented, though rich, is poor. The person who is contented, though poor, is rich. This true wealth is contentment. This true wealth, knowing that inside is where you find infinite compassion and wisdom and joy. Someone asked me the other day what I did to get joy, and I was thinking, joy isn't something that you get, it's something that you give. It's just there all the time. And when you act on it, it just gets spread around. If you are diligent in your devotion to progress, training will not be difficult for you. Therefore, be diligent and devote yourself to progress, just as a small stream, ever flowing, can bore holes in rocks. If the mind of the trainee is often inattentive and remiss, it will be just the same as making a fire by friction and blowing on it before it's hot enough to catch a blaze. Although your desire to train can blaze up, the fires of training are hard to arrive at. This is what I call devotion to progress. And sometimes isn't progress what you think it is? Sometimes progress is seeing all those things that you need to do that you didn't want to look at. Because until you can see them, you can't do something about them. And so very often this progress is to see our fears and greeds and angers and recognize, oh, I don't really have to do that anymore. There was a story I've told a number of times about a man who was one of these hellfire and damnation type preachers, and he had a car accident and watched himself going into the hospital and the ambulance and people working on him. And he went into the light and he had this experience where this man in white, who he identified with Christ because he was Christian, was giving him a review of his life, and it wasn't a linear thing. It was just anywhere he looked was his life. And he saw himself giving this talk about hellfire and damnation, and he was terrifying this little boy who was about 9 years old, and he didn't know him very well. But he could feel at that point the terror that he was creating in this child. And this being who was dressed in white walked over and said, a very calm voice, just said, "Well, I guess you won't have to be saying that anymore." There was no judgment in it. It wasn't that he was a bad person, but he just had to see that, you know, creating fear in somebody to get them to do practice religion isn't the right way to do it. The purpose of religion is to free yourself from the fear, free yourself from the anger. But you have to see what it is that you do that generates fear or generates anger or generates greed. And so that looking at that may not necessarily be something that you would consider progress. But in fact, until we can see what it is that needs changing, we're really not doing the best we can. Because part of doing the best we can is to see where there's room to take that step. There's another step to take. So we have to see where we get a little bit lazy, or where we see that we're trying to do too much, or when we're seeing one of the extremes that we fall into, and to come back to that middle way. Find that there is a way of doing these things with joy and with humor and lightness, and it's possible to make progress even when we're looking at the things that need changing. But we have to look at them through the eyes of compassion, not through judgment. Seek fine understanding, search out good assistance, and do not neglect being mindful. If you're one who does not neglect mindfulness, the thieves of passional defilement will not be able to enter. Therefore, always keep your minds alert, for the one who loses mindfulness loses his merits and virtues. When the strength of your mindfulness is constant and vigorous, though the five desires would break in to rob you, they will not harm you. You will be as one who puts on armor before entering a battle, and will have nothing to fear. This is what I call not neglecting mindfulness. That safety, that putting on the armor, is the commitment to the precepts. That is the putting the meditation into action. That's the thing that keeps us from getting blown around by the senses. He was trained as a warrior, because he came from the warrior class, so he uses battle imagery here. But the merit of taking the precepts, the merit of keeping, of doing your meditation, is the armor that we have. When you achieve meditation, and achieve is a word that I'm not completely comfortable with, because I see meditation as a constant process of achieving, not something that you get and can hold on to. But when you're meditating, your heart is not in turmoil or your mind scattered. Just as a household that would be frugal with water arranges dikes and the pond banks carefully, So a trainee does likewise. Therefore, this, for the sake of the water of discriminate wisdom, the waters of compassion, practice meditation well, that you may prevent the loss of that water through leaks caused by the defiling passions. This is what I call doing meditation. When you have discriminate wisdom, you will not be attached to desires. The desires themselves are not the problem. It's the clinging that's the problem. Because anything we cling to turns it into suffering. When you can hold those things lightly, look at the universe. It's held in emptiness. Reverend Master Chushin had this lovely phrase that which fills and contains all things. If you realize what fills us and what holds us, it's the unborn, it's the undying, it's this whole universe that is filled with compassion. Our whole beings are filled with compassion and love and wisdom. But until we open our hearts to that, we don't know that. We have to be able to not cling to wanting something or not wanting. We have to open ourselves up. As we do that, we can know what fills us. We can know what contains us. Genuine discriminate wisdom is the sturdy craft that ferries others across the sea of old age, disease, and death. It is also a great bright lamp for the darkness of ignorance, a wonderful curative for all disease and suffering. Keep in mind that you have received the teachings. Do not let yourself be forgetful of them and thereby lose them. Always be as diligent as possible in your practice and mastery of them. This next sentence I have some trouble with because I don't completely understand it, but it says, the unreality of the unconditioned after death spawns gloom and regret. I think that has to do with doubting the reality of the teaching. Like a good physician, I understand illness and prescribe curatives for you to take. Not to take them is not the doctor's fault. And the medicine that we have is this practice. The medicine is the precepts. The medicine is the meditation. The teaching that to spiritually benefit yourself by training benefits others contains all. It's an incredible line. Because if you truly are doing your practice, there's no self involved in it. And when there's no self involved in it, you're actually helping everyone. But to be able to do this requires this heart of modesty, this heart of willingness and the joy in the process. So the Buddha said, were I to abide longer, there would still be no more to obtain from me than this. With wholehearted devotion, always seek to get back on the path. All that is mutable and immutable in all worlds defeats and destroys the signs of uncertainty. Bring them to a halt. The meditation that we do, that mindfulness that we do, has to do with a deep understanding of the nature of thought. I had this wonderful quote from Pema Chodron about the thoughts have no substance. When thoughts arise, it might occur to you to wonder where they come from. Where do they come from? It seems as if they come from nowhere. You're just faithfully following your breath and wham, you're in Hawaii surfing. Where did it come from? And where does it go? Big drama. Big drama's happening. Big drama. It's only noon. this is extremely heavy. Then a car horn honks, and suddenly you're not in the same drama anymore. You're in another drama altogether. She was once instructed to meditate on thoughts, and she investigated the nature of thought for 2 whole months. So she says, I can tell you firsthand that you can never find a thought. There is nothing there of substance, but our minds make it extremely a big deal. And this is what the Buddha is trying to teach us in his sermon on his deathbed there, that we create these dramas by giving substance to that which has no substance, by believing the self is a reality, and that our likes and our dislikes are really important. When he finished giving his talk, he asked the monks if they had any doubts, and nobody asked any questions. And he asked 3 times, no questions. So Anuruddha, who was his disciple with this ability to understand what was going on other people's minds, he surveyed the whole assembly of monks. And he was able to report to the Buddha, nobody had any doubts. They had been carried across. And in the photo, the picture on the death of the Buddha, Anuruddha is shown just below the Buddha's mother, who's coming down from heaven to watch his death. And because he was able to understand the nature of thoughts, he was able to put the Buddha's mind at ease that none of the monks there had any problems. And this grounding ourselves in the precepts, grounding ourselves in meditation, seeing through those thoughts that give rise to our likes and our dislikes and our fears and greeds and angers. If you can see through them, then there's no problem in either birth or death. When Elizabeth Kubler-Ross was studying people who were dying, she went through basically 4 stages. I can only remember about 3 of them. But the first is denial, and the second is anger. The last one is acceptance. And this living out your life to the end allows you that, I guess I didn't read that quote about how it's the suffering, it's like what Rev. Master Jiu called the meat tenderizer. The experience of suffering is simply the result of karmic consequences. Like karma is action, the consequences are feelings. So when we feel something as suffering, it's because there's something we don't quite understand. And that understanding comes out of experiencing those things that are difficult in life, as well as the things that are wonderful in life. But the suffering is this meat tenderizer, softening us up. And that softness is what allows the acceptance to happen. And this is why it's so helpful to live out life to the end, even though there's a lot of difficulties involved in the last illnesses. Or at least sometimes. Sometimes it's just off like a light bulb. But whatever the situation, our willingness to accept the fact that this first noble truth, that suffering exists, is an essential part of our process as human beings, to be able to convert that ignorance into understanding. Because it's our willingness to shift our perception on how we view these things. And as we look at them through these eyes of acceptance, then the things that happen to us are okay. They're just there for us to learn from. No matter how difficult or painful it might seem at the time, it's okay. And that acceptance, that opening our heart to them, is what patience or forbearance is. is all about. It's making the heart big enough to hold these sharp things and not be hurt or damaged by them. And it's a question of our choosing to open up, our choosing to not grasp, our choosing to accept the situation that we have as human beings and see, I can shift my perception. I can see this in a way that allows me to learn. I can see it in a way that allows me to see something that I haven't seen before. And that little subtle shift, it's just like tuning your radio. You don't have to keep it on static. But most of us get very upset with static. We don't realize that we have to do this little fine-tuning. So, thank you all. Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha.